Welcome to Unburied Books, a podcast reading through the NYRB classics. I'm Kasia.
And I'm Dylan. We are joined this week by Linda Rosenkrantz, the author of Talk, first published in 1968.
And this is the first time we have had an NYRB classics author on the main show talking about their book.
What an honor. It's so exciting.
Really is. But first, before we get to that, we must share this week's book recommendation, which comes from Will Copeland. He recommends The Lost Weekend by Charles Jackson.
Will liked to mention that this book, he likes the movie that's based on, which won Best Picture, but he said the book is much more horrifying.
Good.
And something he said also, that a little fun fact was, there were some authors or maybe even readers that had to put the book down because they still wanted to be able to drink alcohol in their lives.
I see.
It's intense.
If you want to share a recommendation on the show, consider signing up to our Patreon. Our most recent episode is a conversation with Amit Chowdhury, who is also an NYRB Classics author, but that's a more wide-ranging discussion about his career as a whole. Super great episode.
It's amazing to talk with him.
And there's a good store of material back there now. It's a good time to sign up.
We're inspired by our conversation with him all the time.
It's true. We continue to talk about it. Now for the blurb. It's the summer of 1965, and Emily, Vincent, and Marcia are at the beach. All three are ambitious and artistic, all are hovering around 30, and all are deeply and mercilessly invested in analyzing themselves and everyone around them. The friends discuss sex, shrinks, psychedelics, sculpture, and S&M in an ongoing dialogue where anything goes and no topic is off limits. Talk is the result of these conversations, recorded by Linda Rosenkrantz, and transformed into a novel whose form and content put it well ahead of its time.
And now let's talk with the author of Talk.
Welcome, Linda. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Sorry about the technical difficulties, but I guess this is what tape recording, the struggles might be parallel to what you went through now in the 21st century.
Yeah, definitely.
So we wanted to start kind of more recently, when NYRB Classics reprinted this book in 2015. What was it like? What was that experience like, having people read it for the first time or experience the book as if it was new?
Well, it was a joyful experience, because the first time around was not a very pleasant experience.
Really?
Yeah. It wasn't widely reviewed, and the reviews were pretty negative. That I was lazy and can't you write? This is tape, you know, it's like taping. Very negative. And it was the opposite. The minute the NYRB came out, it started being taken very seriously. I mean, it was presented differently. The first time it was presented as pure fiction.
Mm.
And they were afraid, the publisher Putnam were afraid to say that it was taped.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
So that when we talked about it with the people at New York Review, I insisted on it being the way it was supposed to be presented, as tapes, which is, you know, what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so once they did that, I mean, it got a completely different reception. It was very, very positive.
Yeah. And it seems like a book, you know, somewhat ahead of its time. Now you go to Brooklyn art shows and they have, you know, tape record like features, or, you know, there's things like reality TV or a show like Girls that is sort of like this capture of real life, quote unquote. What made you sort of, before all that, decide to pursue an idea of a tape recording book in this way?
Well, it's hard to say. It's an idea that just hit me. I had rented a house in the Hamptons, and I was getting ready to go, and the idea just came that wouldn't it be interesting. At that time, I thought I was going to record a lot more than the three people. I was just going to turn the tape recorder on and see what happened. And what happened was, it was impossible to transcribe, you know, a lot of different voices speaking at the same time. So I narrowed it down to the three.
Mm-hmm.
One of whom was me.
And I see an idea of self-portraiture with the book as well in the reprint, how a photo of you is the cover art.
Right.
Do you remember what it was like to pick that out as the choice for the cover?
Well, that photo was taken specifically. It was during the winter in New York. And so I went to Florida with a friend, a coworker at Sotheby's, specifically to take a picture on the beach.
Oh, okay.
A little microphone showing on it too.
So it was taken after the book was actually completed.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
It was taken for that edition, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. What was the actual process like? Because there are pictures of you with that tape recorder. It's pretty bulky. It's not just like carrying around a cell phone.
There were more than one tape recorder. There was the one big reel-to-reel bulky one, which you couldn't carry around.
Uh-huh.
But I also had a couple of smaller ones that I would take to the beach.
Oh, okay.
Other places, yeah.
And was the tape expensive at the time? Were you trying to conserve, or were you just all in on recording as much as you could?
It certainly wasn't expensive. They were very cheap. So there were no constraints. I wasn't trying to conserve tape.
Were there any constraints about the people that you were recording, the process of trying to get them to accept that into their normal everyday life at that point?
Well, when it was narrowed down to the three of us, they were very enthusiastic from the beginning and no problem.
Do you still have the tapes or transcripts, and do you revisit them?
Well, that is a very delicate question. I've been moving around a lot in the last 2 years, and the tapes have not... I don't have the tapes. They're in terrible condition anyway. This has been sort of a painful thing. A lot of stuff didn't get moved out of my house when it should have been.
When you you left the beach and you finished the tape recording, in a way, your work was only just beginning because you had to go back through and transcribe all of that.
That took about a year.
Wow.
It was another year of editing.
Right.
So I was working full time, you know, I was doing this at night.
What was the transcribing and editing process like? I mean, I imagine it was like physically difficult, tedious to go through and do all of that, but then also to hear your own self speak or to go back and listen to conversations again.
Well, it was sort of enjoyable, actually, listening to it, you know, seeing what was actually there. And my voice is not heard that much. I wasn't one. The other two really carried the burden of it more than me.
Mm. What made you choose this trio that you sort of work with? Why was it these two that you decided to go with?
Well, they were my closest friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very verbal and funny, and
yeah, they were.
So that was an easy decision.
It made it very enjoyable to read to be with this little group here.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Glad you enjoyed it.
When you first looked at your transcripts, was there a moment where you wondered where you might take it? Because I imagine you could have turned that raw material into any number of different books, but you shaped it into this particular one. What was going through your mind at that time? How did you make those editorial decisions?
It's been a while now to try to remember Sure. my process. I think once I decided to have chapter headings and to organize it that way, it was relatively easy from that point on.
Mm-hmm. I like the chapter headings a lot because it sort of sets up a situation, a conundrum. And we already have enough familiarity with these characters as we get through the book that it's like, what is going to happen at the clam dinner?
Right.
What is going to happen when, you know, Vinny and Emily go dancing? We have some sort of expectation, and then whatever happened in the book was always sort of expected and surprising given how these characters go. And that was always really fun. So I'm glad you added the chapter titles.
Oh, good.
I was curious about this when I was reading it. Were you really committed to the reality portion of it, or did you ever go back and massage some of what was said? Because it seems sometimes that the characters were so clever and so sharp that maybe there was some touch-ups later.
Well, I had to edit it, but I didn't really make changes in their dialogue.
Okay.
Yeah, I tried to keep it as real as I could.
There's definitely a spectrum between like fact and fiction and the idea of what a quote-unquote novel is. Where do you feel like your work fell into that?
Well, I didn't really think of it as a novel. I thought of it as sort of a cross between a novel and an art project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was very much a product of, or very much influenced by what was going on in other art forms at that in the 60s, where there was a new emphasis on reality. Artists were using photographs as bases for their work. And Rauschenberg made the statement of trying to narrow the gap between art and life. And there was Warhol's films and the new journalism and cinema verite. A lot of artists in different realms were looking at reality in a different way, I think, certainly in the art world.
So given that the book does mirror in many ways the pace of life, which isn't necessarily always action-packed, a lot of the scenes in the book discuss conversations or other people that are happening outside of what we're actually granted access to in the book. Did you wrestle with the idea that, like, the words and the conversations passing between these characters were enough action in and of themselves to keep readers engaged?
I think so. There was a very dramatic scene at the end, which somehow or other I didn't take.
Oh.
Which would have been a really climactic scene.
Do you regret not having that tape for the book?
Well, you know, I don't think about it so much anymore, but I think I did regret it at the time.
I don't really think that we're missing a climax, at least. I think everything there felt really whole.
Well, you felt like the dinner scene was kind of the climax.
Yeah, there's a tumultuous dinner towards the back end that I think was sort of where, you know, the rising action hit its peak in a way. I do want to also talk about, when you're talking about this sort of time period, there are certain, you know, themes that run through the book, contemporaneous to time, like psychoanalysis, pop culture, drugs, sex, etc. Were those chosen consciously, or were they more...
I was actually kind of shocked at how much there was about therapy.
Oh.
Okay.
I mean, I knew the sex was there. That I knew.
But it was like a revelation when you went back and reviewed it.
Yeah, that it was so prominent.
Yeah, when you reflect on the book now, do you see these characters as avatars, sort of their time period, of their age, and things like that?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, being one of those characters, it's hard for me to have any distance from it. And one of the characters has died since.
It's often written about as a time capsule, but I could see how if that was actually your personal experience, it would be very hard to see it through that lens. One of the really fascinating tensions in the book is that between this intense friendship between the three and then all of the romantic dalliances that they're obsessed with discussing and going over and playing games and swapping horrible stories about. Did you see these as antithetical forces, that between like friendship and maybe like more long-term romantic commitment? Because that question does come up between Marcia and Vincent near the end, that maybe Vincent is like blocking other men from coming into Marcia's life.
Well, that was the big scene that was left out.
Oh.
So, but a couple of people came in and I didn't tape them because they weren't part of the trio, but they were trying to force an encounter on that subject of whether he was keeping other men away.
I see. Okay. I see. I still felt that idea was very much present in the book, even if that particular scene wasn't there, wasn't recorded.
Yeah, it was there. Yeah, definitely. In later life, Vincent did get married and have children.
Mm.
He got married twice, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow. We also talk about like how figuring out when or how to record things. One of our favorite parts was when Marcia walks in on Emily and Vincent talking about Marcia. And, you know, she's like, were you talking about me? And they were like, you can play the tape back. And you decide to, it was a really interesting decision. You decide to play basically the entire chapter back. It's not just, you know, tape is repeated or something.
Yeah.
There was this real fourth wall break where I felt the process, the artistry coming out in that moment. Why did you choose to reprint the dialogue in its entirety?
You know, I really should have reread the book this morning because I don't remember that.
Well, just the way that you make the tape recording, you don't try to eliminate the idea that this was being taped between the characters. That's present in the book.
Yeah.
That was important to you to keep that in?
Yeah. It was, yes.
It does also sort of envelop all those new wave
ideas, yeah.
In itself.
I guess so, yeah.
After finishing tape, you continued using the tape recording technique in some other projects, the Peter Hujar's Day, and then
that's the most recent, and that's been very well received.
Yeah, and then you did another one about ex-boyfriends coming in and making them dinner.
Yeah, that's yet to be finished or published. Yeah, that I did right after talk. I invited about a dozen ex-boyfriends separately to dinner, served them the same menu, and recorded the entire evening from the moment they walked in until they left.
That sounds fascinating, especially after, yeah, you know, hearing the Marcia character, like, experience love. Like, I would really want to read that book.
Oh, you'll have to read it on typewritten version. I mean, it was problematic because a lot of them were married, and it just became too complicated. Mm. And at this point in time, quite a few of them have died, or widows, and yeah, I don't think that'll ever see the light of day. The PU jar was part of another series that was supposed to be a day in the life, where I had people write down everything they did in one particular day that they chose, and then would meet with me, and we would tape the activities of the day. And Peter was the first one I did. And the second was Chuck Close. I mean, none of these people were as entertaining as Emily and Vincent, unfortunately. So you'd have to really pick your victims.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Emily and Vincent definitely were special characters, as emphasized by the fact that I thought you probably must have thought about making up some of their quips, because they seemed just like impossibly smart. But why do you think that you still like were attached to the idea of experimenting with tape recording? Like talk, when you finished talk, you weren't done with that idea. You still were, like, wanted to continue with it.
Yeah, well, I was very happy with talk, and I thought I could take it further. I mean, I've always been attracted to sort of eccentric methods. When I wrote a childhood memoir, and it's called My Life as a List, and that was in list form.
Right.
So I don't know. My mind just seems to go towards those unusual methods.
Mm-hmm. Was there any decision about what to name the characters, to conceal identities or reinterpret them in a certain way?
The other two always wanted their identities concealed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just chose those names.
Gotcha.
I was at one time a movie name expert, so names are right. Important to me.
I guess that's important when you're tape recording people too. You got to have the names. Did this experience have a larger effect on the other nonfiction writing that you did, beyond just like your the fact that you're drawn to eccentric methods?
I mean, I haven't done much conventional writing. I mean, I started out that way with short stories and things. I mean, I don't think I would think of trying to write a conventional novel. It just doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah, there's an interesting discussion of this in a way in talk, where Vincent is kind of reassuring Marcia and saying, you know, we all fail in some way, and like our inability in a certain medium is what sort of defines our style. And he says that about the tape recording book. Do you think that has held true for you? Was there wisdom in that comment?
I don't know. I think at one point one of them says, we're writing your book for you.
Yeah. Yeah, you're lazy. That's what he says, yeah.
Yeah, and that was true in a sense, certainly.
But like you said, the process was so specific and arduous to edit it in that way and
yeah,
transcribe it that you know, it took as much work as it would to write any conventional novel, oh, just absolutely. In a different form.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was presented as pure fiction the first time around was very disappointing because, you know, just sort of denied what I was trying to do. And I'm pretty sure they had the other two people sign every page of the manuscript.
Really?
Oh.
That's funny.
That's very cool.
I mean, they were very, I mean, the poor editor who bought the book for Putnam, I think was constantly met with criticism and, you know, why did you buy this? I think it was very difficult for him, which was the opposite of what happened with, you know, the second time around. And it being called a classic was very major for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's undeniable, though.
Thank you.
I think there's one final question that Cassie and I have been discussing this entire week, reading the book, leading up to this conversation. But do you think talk could be written now? Because art and conversation have changed significantly, you know, since this time. You know, the nature of talk is just sort of different in the social media age, the mm-hmm. phone calling age. Like, what do you think about that?
I think this stands apart from that. I think it could still be done.
Mm.
A lot was made in the review of the second time around of how contemporary it seemed and how, although it was of its time, it seemed to hold up as you know, not just of that period.
Yeah. I think the difference is I would see these sorts of real moments of vulnerability or things like that hidden behind a message board. The fact that mm-hmm. this is spoken in a physical place and, you know, one person might turn to the other and be like, look at that person standing next to us on the beach. That's what feels a little bit more divorced for me. And so it kind of enlightens those things that has, where the method of communication has felt like it's changed, like the emotions are still the same. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but has it really changed? I mean, aren't those two separate things? Don't people still have conversations about the person on the next blanket on the beach?
I think they probably do. Yeah, I just think it's an interesting question because what I got from the book was this real intensity of the bonds between the characters. And part of that, I think, maybe had to do with today, if I walked past a group of 30-year-olds on the beach, they'd probably have earphones in or be texting other people. And like when you're in a house in an isolated area away from your normal community for several months or whatever it was, a certain bond develops out of that, which leads to heightened drama, which your book really captures.
Right. And you don't think that exists anymore?
I think that it's different.
Yeah.
But I think that the perspectives and the life experiences feel very, very contemporary. As this book was compared to Lena Dunham's Girls or Broad City TV show.
Yeah.
How did you feel about being compared to like those more modern cultural products?
Well, I felt that those characters were very close to the people in talk.
Mm-hmm.
And that their intimacy. And Lena Dunham, by the way, was a big fan of talk.
Right, right. They printed some excerpts of X, right?
Yeah, they made them into graphic form. They took a few chapters and got a cartoonist to make it into a comic strip form.
That's very cool.
Which was a lot of fun, yeah.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention? Any memories that have been brought back from the book at all?
Well, I still feel close to those two people, one dead, one alive. You know, it's almost 50 years since it was written. So I'm a different person. You know, I've had a long marriage. And Vincent moved to the south of France, where he stayed until the rest of his life. Emily has a lot of physical problems, and she's a different person. But we talk. When we talk on the phone, it's very much like talk.
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
That really is.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I have, you know, great memories of it. It was my first published book. It had a very difficult path to publication. It was rejected time and time again. People just didn't get it. So, having the second edition come out was just such a, you know, it just even more worthwhile.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. And I saw that it was translated into a couple other languages as well.
Yeah, Spanish and Italian.
Yeah, that must have been gratifying.
Yeah, that was very nice, yeah. And those people were very supportive and very nice to work with.
Wonderful. And I mean, that's why we started this podcast independently of NYRB, but I think it was because of, you know, NYRB's mission to bring these books back that deserve to be read again, and that has made us passionate about the series, and, you know, to the point where we pick up Talk and enjoy it.
It's really interesting what you're doing. I mean, I wonder how many authors are available. I mean, it seems like you use a lot of translators and people who just are talking about the books.
Yeah, it's true. It's tough to find any, especially because the classics mainly, I think they're like prime time of republishes from like the 1920s. So there's not a lot of authors still around from most of the books they publish. But, you know, it's an honor to have, you know, a writer of these words that we get to talk about on the show. And we are hoping to try to find more in this way. So,
yeah, I think it's a great series to do. It was a great idea.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was a pleasure.
She brought a lot of interesting insights about, you know, where these characters took their lives that I would really enjoyed, or even the process. There was the conversation that's basically the climax of their trip together.
That was...
She wasn't able to record it because there was other people in the room and it wouldn't be able to fit into the book. So I thought it was really cool getting the behind the scenes look at how a book like this especially is made.
Yeah. And the fact that the Marcia character is still in conversation with the Emily character.
It was wonderful.
I thought it was very sweet. And, you know, maybe there's a sequel in the future. Who knows?
I would love it.
We can only hope that our podcast could be half as interesting as the book talk.
It's very true.
Well, thank you for listening to Unburied Books. Our theme music is composed by John Hoekstra.
If you can, leave us a review and a rating on your podcast platform. It always helps. Drop us a follow. You can reach us at Twitter, Instagram, or Gmail at Unburied Books. We'd love to hear from you and keep up with you.
And join us again in 2 weeks when we discuss another classic.